Hello, I'm Lina Ahmedou. Welcome to Health Chat. The World Health Organization says outbreaks of vaccine-preventable diseases have become more common over the past few years. Diseases such as cholera and yellow fever have increased significantly, and observers say inequalities in accessing vaccines is partly to blame. An initiative launched last year aims to reduce the gap in vaccine access in underserved communities, among other things. Pfizer and Morgan State University have launched an inaugural Doctor of Public Health Fellowship in Vaccines Medical Development. The two-year program kicked off late last year and aimed to expand the number of minority scholar practitioners in the fields of medical development, as well as vaccine-related real-world data and analysis. For more insight, I spoke with Monica Ochapa, one of the medical vaccine fellows and doctorate of public health candidate at Morgan State University, and asked her thoughts on the fellowship.
You are a PhD scholar at Morgan State University and an inaugural fellow program with Pfizer. What is this program about?
I'm really excited, by the way, to have gotten at the fellowship. It was quite competitive, and we wanted to understand the main focus, which I'm sure Nikki will talk more about when you speak to her, the director, is more of trying to look at vaccine uptake and hesitancy, whichever way it goes through the lens of equity, and how equity plays a part in vaccine access and uptake. So it was quite competitive. Everybody applied, and I was actually nervous until I got the letter saying I was accepted, and it's been a great ride so far, although it's been just a few days, and I'm hoping for the best in these 2 years.
Vaccine equity, vaccine access, and vaccine acceptance has been a challenge. We've seen it play during the COVID-19 pandemic. Yeah. So talk to us about your research. What does it consist of?
So my research, as it concerns quality improvement tools in that area, is more of how to streamline the process, get into community and get community involved. You know, a major part of vaccine acceptance, I'd say, is more of information and dissecting the information such that the misinformation out there does not overpower the information that science brings and what science can do in communities, especially communities of color. Like you said, with COVID-19, we saw what happened with the misinformation. And going back to recent years with what has happened with anti-vaxxers campaign and all of that, is more imperative right now to actually put our own information out there, talk more in every spaces we get. It's not only in the journals or in all other spaces, but even on social media where most misinformation are spread, we need to also be visible there, and in community who have lower vaccine uptake. So the hope is that using all these public health quality improvement tools, and the fact that we have the background in community engagement and community-based participatory research, the hope is to involve community more, talk about this, and hopefully we'll see more adoption and increase in vaccine uptake.
And if you can tell us about some of the communities that your research will be focusing on, what do you think is one of the major impediments in making vaccine more accessible?
Yeah, so that is complex. It's not just one thing. And we can go back as far as the syphilis experiment and how that had at least increased distrust in the medical profession and all of that. And the fact that most times people don't believe that, even though it's good for them, they think there's an ulterior motive. But more recently is more of the misinformation and all the stuff that go behind, and people saying all sorts of things. And, you know, there's power in communication, especially in the grapevine. coming from Africa, I understand this too, because I remember during the Ebola crisis, people talking about drinking salt water and all of that. And then people are dying from the side effect of what the grapevine, the information that comes from the grapevine. So it is important to actually look at that. You look at science, but then you look at the power of what elders are saying in the communities, what people are saying in the community, especially people who don't have the facts. So it is multifaceted when it comes to vaccine hesitancy. It's not just one issue that stops people from that. That's why the effort should be more of including communities in this process so that they know it from the beginning to the end. You don't just wake up and say, hey, we have this for you. We think it will be good. Then you now meet this kind of barrier of saying, who told you we needed this? Who told you this is what we want? You should have talked to us first. So it's multifaceted. It's not just one thing that causes this barrier.
So talk to us about the community you will be focusing on during your research and what the research will look like.
So now we are still working through that. But mostly, I am sure my work will be more with underserved communities. It doesn't matter the race or the sub sections, but it's more of underserved community. It could be with purely communities of color. It could be with communities in Africa, and it could be the Appalachia here in the United States. But what I know, although we are just walking through the process, is that whatever we do will be geared more to underserved communities.
At the end of the fellowship, what will success look like for you?
Well, for me, it will mean that in some way, I've contributed to making the lived human experience more humane for everyone. The hope is that whatever I do contribute in some way in improving the health outcomes of the communities I'll be working for. If any of that is achieved, then I can say this was successful, because it's not just being there and talking about it, but actually making impact and seeing that the people you are actually serving, in some way, their lives are improved by the work you do.
That was Pfizer Medical Vaccine Fellow Monica Ochapa. Nguhemen Tingir is the second scholar recipient of the Pfizer and Morgan State University's Medical Vaccine Fellowship. I asked her what she hopes to accomplish during the program.
You were just selected to be a fellow for the Pfizer inaugural vaccine fellowship. First and foremost, let me have your reaction for this and what your work will consist of.
Okay, thank you. Yes, I was recently selected to be an inaugural fellow on the Pfizer-Morgan collaboration on vaccines and medical development. And I stand to gain, there are a lot of things that I stand to gain, developing therapy area expertise, engaging the scientific community, and to building technical and professional skills, which are just a few things I stand to gain on the fellowship. And I was quite pleased to be selected. Pfizer's core values resonate quite well with me. Their values of courage, excellence, joy, and especially equity resonate quite well with me. And this fellowship, I believe, is a testament to that.
So talk to us about your work, the research that you'll be focusing on.
I'm interested in maternal and child health, and following the inaugural meeting we had with the Pfizer team, I understand that we were able to meet quite a number of team members we'll be working with, and they have a maternal immunization or vaccine program. So I believe I'm interested in vaccine hesitancy and skepticism. So I believe my research area would be in that line. I've not come up with the complete details yet, but it will be around vaccine hesitancy and skepticism among pregnant women.
You were able to navigate different health systems with this rich background of yours. When we talk about strengthening health systems in Africa in general, Nigeria in particular, where you're from, where do you see some of the priorities?
When it comes to health system strengthening, there is no one size fit all, as the challenges and the concerns of the population vary by region, beliefs and cultures. But a very important element of strengthening health systems is stakeholder engagement. Engaging the population, those that are most affected or involved, that will be most affected who are in whatever you're trying to strengthen, is very important. Engaging them and getting their buy-in and their thoughts with regards planning and implementation is key to success, in my experience. And when they are involved in the planning and the programming, eventually they take ownership of the process and run with it to ensure that it succeeds. Another important element is the leadership buy-in, because the leadership drives implementation. They are the ones that will ensure that the policies are favorable to ensure that the change occurs. And they will also provide the funding that will drive the change. So leadership buy-in, stakeholder engagement, all together tie up to ensure the system strengthening. And it takes time. It doesn't happen overnight. It takes time. The engagement, the buy-in from the leadership, all of this takes time, but eventually they are worth it.
When we look at the challenges that Africa is confronted with different priorities, where does the money go when we want to strengthen a health system?
In strengthening health system, I believe that aside from the funding, because the government has to be one to will eventually have to fund it, but funding the wrong thing or funding what is not of importance to the population will not take ownership of it. If, for example, they want the population feels that their problem is maternal and child health, and the government instead is funding something else, they are less likely to get involved. So that is why stakeholder engagement is so important from the get-go, that you engage the stakeholders, the population that you're working with, to ensure that what is being funded is what is of importance to them. And if it's important to them, they will take ownership of it. And that is how to build a sustainable, strong system. When the people are involved, it's more likely to be sustainable.
That's a great point. That's a really good point. Coming back to the fellowship, what would success look like for you at the end of it, at the end of this experience?
Oh, wow. There's so much I stand to gain from the fellowship. Following the inaugural meeting with the Pfizer team, I'm in awe of the expertise they have and all the people that we'll be working with. So I hope to take advantage of that, learn from them. And in the end, aside from it, be able to apply what I have learned in when I eventually do graduate in what I am doing going forward. And I hope to teach if I get the opportunity. So I'll be able to also transfer what I have learned to others and also implement it in processes that I'll be involved in.
That was Morgan State University and Pfizer Fellowship recipient Nguhemen Tengir. You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It's time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
We are bringing women voices to the conversation on things that matter to the hearts and minds of women. From right here in the nation's capital to on the ground from all over the African continent. We hear your voices, our voices, right here on VOA on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC.
Welcome back to Health Chat. On the program today, we take a close look at an initiative to train minority scholar practitioners in the fields of medical development and vaccine analysis, among other things. Ronica Alexander Parrish is a clinical scientist at Pfizer and founding director of the Doctor of Public Health Fellowship in Vaccines Medical Development. She elaborates on the program and why it's important.
Ronica Alexander Parrish, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
You are the developer of the Pfizer inaugural vaccine fellowship. Talk to us about this program.
So actually, it's really, for me, a very personal endeavor, something that I've been thinking about for quite some time. And then just as the atmosphere changed at Pfizer, we got a new CEO in 2019, and they actually decided to embed something that we were already living, but embed the equity value into our corporate behavior. So you'll see courage, excellence, equity, and joy. And you could palpably feel the change in the environment that we knew it was right to do something to change and really bring more people into the fold in Pfizer. So that was in 2019. You fast forward to the pandemic when the world is, you know, not literally, but on fire with so much racial strife, so much change, the loss of life. There was a time we needed to do something differently. Pfizer knew we needed to do something differently to make sure that we understood and took into consideration everything that was happening in our external world so we'll be better able to serve our patients. I said, I'm not going to come to the table to complain. I'm going to come with a solution. And the solution that I brought was this fellowship so that we would have more people that looked like me in a position to make decisions about, you know, how we see our patients, how we include them in our research so that our voices, our lived experience, our not only our expertise, but our lived experience and our understanding, our unique understanding of working with folks who have traditionally been marginalized. How we need to get that voice into the work that we do here, into our evidence generation, and then how we share that information out.
What is the fellowship in terms of the program? What does it consist of?
This particular fellowship is exclusive to public health practitioners. And so that's very important because you see lots of very hyper-specialized folks in the industry, but we really need that public health practitioner perspective in the vaccine space. So it's exclusive to those doctorally prepared practitioner students. Also, we wanted to make sure that we reach our enterprise goals of course, increasing the number of folks from different backgrounds that are a part of the organization. And certainly here in the United States, one of the ways that we do that is through our HBCUs, our historically Black colleges and universities. And so working directly with them, partnering directly with them to really reach that untapped talent. This is where you find the critical mass of excellence that you're able to bring into the organization for that purpose. So those were two of the primary reasons. And then also because our schools of public health, certainly from our HBCUs, you can count them on less than, fewer than one hand, they're grounded in a philosophy of health justice and serving marginalized and urban populations. And so we wanted students that would bring that experience and that mindset into the Pfizer organization. So these were kind of the reasons around partnering this way. It's a two-year immersive experience in partnership with Morgan State University, which is one of those universities that provides that doctoral training in public health. We take them through almost every piece of the medicine's development process so that there's a complete understanding of the entire business of developing a vaccine by the time that they leave. But there's an opportunity to obtain a certification in medicine's development from the IFAP Academy in collaboration with King's College of London. So they are that participation in that program, which is not a part of Pfizer, but being able to obtain that certification is something that is offered as a benefit or is included as a benefit and a necessity, a foundational piece of their training here. And our hope is that they will decide to remain as Pfizer colleagues in the vaccine space. But if they don't, they're prepared to go out and lead and change the narrative in any space, in any biopharma space to choose.
So talk to us about the selection process. What were some of the criteria?
I would say they were pretty generalized, but that's a very specialized population. So you had to be, of course, enrolled in your doctoral program at Morgan State University, of course, in excellent academic standing. But it gets more nuanced when you start to look at the individual candidates. We wanted folks who had demonstrated a commitment to underserved populations in their prior work You may know that folks from a doctoral practitioner program, they're not matriculating all the way through. They have worked, and that's a requirement in order to be in the program. So we wanted people who had extensive field experience, who understood infectious diseases, vaccine-preventable diseases, who had training on the ground in that, who had theoretical background. So there were a number of things that we were looking for in these candidates. And so maybe it was magic for us to be able to get the two candidates that we identified, because they have all of those experience, a global perspective, as well as a domestic perspective here in the United States, a commitment to our underserved populations, experience in a number of infectious diseases, not just those that are serviced by the vaccines that we develop here at Pfizer.
What will success look like at the end of the 2 years?
Okay. So we selected two fellows for this cohort, and we plan to keep the cohort small because, again, the goal is to transition those colleagues into work here in the organization. So I couldn't imagine us creating 10 new jobs every year to grow the organization. But we want to make sure that that investment is something that translates into an opportunity for the fellows. So that's how the cohorts will look. As far as success, success looks like a number of things. Most immediately, it'll be for the fellows to be, of course, to be certified in medicines development, to complete the 2 years and actually transition. That is our marker for success. We want it, of course, to be an enjoyable experience and for them to want to come back. We also, kind of the intangibles, want to build that relationship between public health and biopharma. There's often this rift between those two people in each area, not seeing themselves as a part of each other. But biopharma, and certainly in the vaccine space, is really a part of the public health ecosystem. And so we want these students to kind of serve that purpose, actually to, you know, open the window and open the door so we can look inside, because we are individuals and we make up those organizations. And so when you have the voice of public health embedded into the medicines development process, you can't go wrong there. So that'll be really a win for us as well. And then to further partner in keeping with Pfizer's HBCU strategy here in the US, and certainly we'll look at what that means globally, but to continue to partner with organizations that have previously not been tapped for those voices that have not been at the table. So in the US, that looks like our HBCUs and minority serving institutions. And we will, of course, include, maybe the fellows will be able to help us understand what that looks like globally as we work toward expanding our efforts toward including everyone's voice at the table. So that's what success looks like for me, both tangibly and long-term.
That was Ronica Alexandra Parrish, a clinical scientist at Pfizer and founding director of the Doctor in Public Health Fellowship. We turn now to malnutrition. Millions of children in the Horn of Africa are suffering dire drought conditions, including many with severe acute malnutrition. UNICEF puts the number at 20.2 million. That's more than double the number just 5 months ago. The reason is threefold: conflicts, climate change, and global inflation, according to the UN Children's Agency. For more on the threat facing children in Ethiopia, Kenya, and Somalia, VOA's Carol Van Dam spoke with Leke Van der Veel, UNICEF's Deputy Regional Director for Eastern and Southern Africa, who says UNICEF has been working in the Horn for a long time to help malnourished children recover, but this kind of drought is unprecedented.
We saw a deterioration in the last 6 months, and right now we have around 20 million plus children facing threat of hunger, thirst, and other diseases because of the drought and the secondary impact that a long-lasting drought has had on those children in the Horn of Africa.
What is UNICEF doing in Ethiopia, Kenya, and Somalia to alleviate severe hunger and thirst there?
Yeah, we are doing a lot. Of course, more needs to be done. But we've been working in these countries for many decades. And we've had programs all along to ensure that those children were receiving basic services and health, and that they had enough food and water and clean water, schooling and learning. But because of the drought, we've seen many families uprooting themselves, looking for water. looking for more livelihoods because their livelihoods are destroyed. And our response, therefore, has to be adjusted to ensure that those uprooted families and children that face now hunger and more diseases are being catered for. So we do a lot of acute malnutrition treatment. So when children are really very malnourished, especially the youngest one, that's absolutely dangerous. We help them in getting ready to use therapeutic food, and they will then recover and outside the danger zone so they can go home and then survive on a normal diet. But of course, the normal diets are not normal in these types of droughts. So UNICEF is also helping with many UN partners and other partners to ensure that families have a decent diet.
You know, you say these kinds of droughts. This one seems like it's been going on for a long time, more than 6 months, right? So that's kind of unprecedented.
Yeah, this one has been absolutely very powerful and sad, because this is we're going to the sixth rainy season that might fail. So we're talking about the worst in 40 years. And this has been accumulating, because the first rainy season that doesn't work, of course, is still manageable. But we're going towards the sixth. So it gets harder and harder for those families and communities to be resilient.
And also the time that they've been uprooted, when you think about that, sometimes I would imagine it's permanent when these people are displaced for 6 months or more with their children. Do they often not come back to their homes?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. And there you can also see that, of course, such drought is not reversible anymore. I mean, there's environmental degradation. So if there's a real big drought and the crops are not working, and of course the cattle can't be fed or there's no water, then it's not a possibility for those families to go back and create a new livelihood. And that is something that the climate crisis has shown us, that it's not so easy to bounce back, because once a drought has really settled in, and there's nothing to bounce back from, the environmental degradation is tremendous.
That was my colleague Carol Van Damme speaking with UNICEF's Deputy Regional Director, Leakey Van de Viel. That's all for this edition of Health Chat. For more health news and medical breakthroughs, visit voaafrica.com. Thank you all for joining us, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Lenore Moudou, in Washington. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.
VOA Africa would like to hear from you. Send us a text message or a voice note on WhatsApp 24/7. Leave a comment, request, or send us a greeting, and you could be hearing your message on VOA Africa. Simply dial the international code plus 1, then 202-258-3076. We are always happy to hear from you. The number again is international code plus 1, then 202-258-3076. VOA Africa, your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music.
Stay tuned every Wednesday and Friday at 9 p.m. UTC time with your pilot, Roger Moon, to listen to the RM Show, where you can respond to our question of the week, get some entertainment news, and enjoy some great music. It's all happening at VOA Africa. God bless. Peace, Africa.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.